Welcome to FICPE's podcast series, FICPE Focus 45. FICPE is the only international NGO whose membership consists entirely of IP attorneys in private practice. The FICPE global community is driven by a shared interest among like-minded people to promote common solutions and advocacy for private practice. The FICPE business family makes the world a little bit smaller, bringing independent IP attorneys from around the globe together to focus on IP issues of global importance. Our host is Louis-Pierre Gravel, a registered patent agent and partner at Bereskin & Parr in Montreal, Canada.
Throughout this podcast, there are photos being referred to on a PowerPoint presentation, which was on display during the webinar. If you'd like to see these photos for reference, head to ficpe.link/Parker1 and ficpe.link/Parker2. Enjoy.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, depending on where you are in the world. Welcome to a special edition of FICPE's Focus 45 webinar series. My name is Sharon Crane. I'm your guest moderator for today. I am a biotech and pharma patent attorney at the Haynes & Boone Law Firm in Washington, D.C. I'm currently Deputy Secretary General of FICPE, as well as co-chair of the Webinar and Diversity Committees. Today, I am thrilled to be talking with Winifred Neisser, who, in addition to being a very accomplished woman in her own right, is here to tell us a story of her mother and aunt, Winifred and Frieda Parker, who broke the color barrier at Purdue University in Indiana in the 1940s and became the first women of color to be allowed to live in the dormitories at that university. Their story begins with Winifred's father and goes up to the governor of Indiana. Several years ago, dormitories at Purdue were actually named in Winifred and Frieda Parker's honor. Before we get into their story, I want to tell you a little bit more about the younger Winifred, Winifred Neisser, who's on the screen with me right now. Welcome, Winifred. Very happy to have you with us. Part of the reason I am the guest moderator today is because Winifred is not only a friend, but a family member. Her son is married to my daughter. So. Winifred serves as executive director of the Angel City Corral, and I'm going to show you a bit of video of the Angel City Corral. I don't know if any of you watch America's Got Talent, but they were semifinalists and really incredibly impressive. I'd like Winifred to tell us also a little bit about sort of the makeup and why the corral was put together. I think that's a really interesting story as well. Winifred joined the choir in 2006 after taking her kids to the holiday concert when she could not stop thinking about the fact that that looks like so much fun. Born into a family that recognized that the arts were an essential part of a full life, she developed a love of music and theater as a child, but never was sure what weight they would have in adulthood. After obtaining an undergraduate degree from Harvard, Radcliffe College, and graduate degrees in education, and later TV and film, she pursued a career that drew on that early arts exposure as a television executive. Her 34-year journey in Hollywood began in children's programming at NBC, where she worked for 14 years in various executive programming positions and oversaw such projects as the Emmy-winning series Jim Henson's Storyteller and over 20 films based on Danielle Steele novels. She continued at Sony Pictures Television, leaving in 2014 as Senior Vice President of Television Movies and Miniseries, where her work included projects such as A Raisin in the Sun, starring P. Diddy, The Hatfields and the McCoys with Kevin Costner, and a franchise with Tom Selleck based on the Jesse Stone book series by Robert Parker. After leaving Sony, Winifred accepted a 2015 fellowship at Harvard's Advanced Leadership Initiative, a third-stage higher education program specifically designed to help business leaders transition to social impact work. In 2016, she also completed the Cultural and Ethnic Arts Leadership Program at Rutgers Business School. Returning to Los Angeles, she rejoined the Angel City Corral, where she had been a singer and board member, and then transitioned to serve in her current role as executive director. And I love talking to people who have more degrees than I do. It's very impressive. Winifred has served on Creative Pathways Task Force through the Los Angeles County Arts Commission and worked on the Inner City Youth Orchestra of Los Angeles. She currently serves on the board of the arts advocacy organization Arts for LA, as well as the board of the Otis College of Art and Design and the advisory board of the Charles Drew Medical Center. She's previously served on other nonprofit boards, including the Harvard University Board of Overseers, Television Academy of Arts and Sciences Board of Governors, and Planned Parenthood of Los Angeles. In this chapter of her life, she's committed to the areas of community development, education, and the arts. She has two adult children, two grandchildren, and lives with her husband, Ken, in Los Angeles. So welcome very much. I don't know if you want to talk about your television background, Winifred, or move right into a little discussion of your current role as executive director of the Angel City Chorale, and then we can move into Frida and Winifred.
I don't know that I have that much to say about my television career, except that it was never boring.
And you met some great people.
I did. I met some very interesting people, and it was very interesting work that because it was always changing, and it was not ever what I thought I was going to be doing. So I was constantly being surprised, but I was very grateful for having those years. And now in this, let me say, the third chapter, I find myself, you know, doing something that I've always enjoyed. I've always enjoyed the singing. And the Angel City Chorale is a very large community choir. And it is made up of people from all over Los Angeles, all kinds of singers, people who were pop singers and choral singers and folk singers and jazz singers coming together, you know, to make music. And we sing all styles. Our youngest member is 19. Our oldest member is 93.
Oh my gosh, that's fantastic.
So it's a community, you know, unto itself. It's kind of like a small town in a big city.
That's really awesome. I really enjoyed hearing, there was a little bit of a discussion in the video from America's Got Talent about why the chorale was made up intentionally to be very diverse. And I think that's really interesting. I am going to try to play for us just a few minutes of a wonderful song that the Angel City Chorale sings and sang on America's Got Talent and really wowed everybody. I'm going to try not to get teary-eyed because I told Winifred I always do every time I listen to it. So I might have to turn off my my video for a minute. You should appreciate that this beginning, when you're hearing the sound of rain and thunder, it's actually all the members of the chorale snapping and clapping and stomping their feet, etc. So let me see if I can share this appropriately. All right, here we go.
Oh,
I'm going to cut that off here. I could listen to that all day, but we are here to talk about the Barker sisters. So that I think we should probably move on.
That is our biggest hit. So it's available on YouTube. People can watch it whenever.
It's amazing. And by the way, I used the version that's on your website rather than using the one from America's Got Talent. So all of you copyers out there listening, I think I did it properly.
Yeah, that was the right thing to do.
Anyway, moving from the younger Winifred to the older Winifred. And actually, when we talked about this before, you told me that your story, and what I loved how you termed it, was the trajectory of your family really started with your grandfather. So I'd love to hear you tell the story starting with your grandfather.
Well, my grandfather grew up or lived in Western Pennsylvania, and his father died when he was 12. I don't know what his father did, but they were pretty modest, lived very modestly. And when his father died, his mother remarried, I don't know how soon after, but, you know, I think about a year or so later. And my grandfather, whose name was Fred Parker, did not get along with the new father. And so he left home, I think around age 14. And he went to Washington, D.C. Now, apparently the family had lived some portion in Washington, D.C., so it wasn't totally foreign territory to him. But he went to Washington, D.C. He worked as a stable boy, and he lived in the stable. And he went to Dunbar High School, which at that time, I think, wasn't called Dunbar High School in Washington, D.C. I think it was still M Street High School.
But it's an amazing high school.
I think it was the first public high school exclusively for Blacks. I think it was the first one in the country.
I think that's right.
Yeah. But it had very good teachers and a very good curriculum. You have to remember at that time when everything was segregated, there weren't that many opportunities for Blacks. And a lot of smart Black people were teachers. Mm-hmm. And so, in some ways, the students benefited from the fact that there weren't so many opportunities. So they got some really good caring, some good caring teachers. So my grandfather was very good at math, and the teachers recognized that. And even though he had no money and no family support, he applied to colleges and he didn't get into any school. And a couple of the teachers took him in and decided to help him figure out how to get to college. And there was a man, Charles Hamilton Houston, who in the Black community is a very famous lawyer, who was the, I think, first general counsel for the NAACP. And he was the first Black man to graduate from Harvard Law School. This was before he went to Harvard Law School. But he had gone to Amherst, and he had also gone to M Street High School. And he came back, and the teachers talked to him, and he helped my grandfather apply and get into Amherst College, which completely changed his life. We have letters, we have pictures, he had scrapbooks from that period of time, and it just opened a whole new world. He ran track, he played on the football team, and he was around other smart people who challenged him. It doesn't mean it was totally easy, because he was also around some rich people, he had no money. And of course, he, ran into racial prejudice, but he also made lifelong friends. And so, we always say in my family that changed the trajectory of the family, because he had that opportunity for that really good education and that exposure to what was possible.
And it just goes to show you what being a mentor means for somebody, and having those examples around you of, how to get ahead, how to succeed.
Absolutely. Somebody looked at him and said, here, let me help you.
Right. Right.
And it's
easy enough to do, right?
It made all the difference. And he spent his life helping other students like himself. The whole time when I was growing up, I was constantly running into people who said, oh, you're Fred Parker's granddaughter. Your father changed my life. Your grandfather changed my life. So, he passed it along. But anyway, he went on to teach in a couple of the small Black colleges on the East Coast, where he met my grandmother. And later he was recruited to teach at a Black high school in Indianapolis, which was called Crispus Attucks High School. This picture is my mother and my Aunt Frida when they graduated from Purdue. This is, it's a very blurry picture, but you know, these were the days of blurry black and white. And this actually used to look worse than it did. Somebody fixed it up for me. And this is my grandfather and my mother in the picture with my grandfather. My mother's on the left. What happened was he was recruited to teach at Crispus Attucks High School, which was a high school that I think was modeled after the Dunbar School. Mm-hmm. Both of my aunt and my mother and their two siblings all went to Crispus Attucks, which, as you can imagine, was particularly tough because my grandfather was there. He and my grandmother, who also went to college, he met her when he was teaching at a college in West Virginia, where she was from. They moved to Indianapolis, and my mother and her sister were born about a year apart. So their birthdays are both in September. And they grew up being as close as two sisters could be. And that friendship lasted their entire life. So they went to Crispus Attucks. My aunt graduated first and went to a school in Arizona. I think it was the University of Arizona, and she hated it. And my mother was the valedictorian in her high school class, and she wanted to go to Cornell. That was her dream. She applied to go to Cornell, and she didn't get it. My grandfather brought my aunt home and helped both girls apply to Purdue, and they both got in.
Well, which Purdue, is a fantastic university in Indiana.
Yeah, it was. And Purdue started there. They were supposed to start in September. And the Purdue handbook said that all freshmen were supposed to live in the dorms. But my mother and my aunt were told that they could not live in the dorms because there was no room. Well, it turns out there were no Black students living in the dorms. And under further investigation from my grandfather, he was told that the Black students couldn't live in the dorms because Purdue was in West Lafayette, Indiana, and West Lafayette had sundowner rules, sundowner laws, which meant no Black people could be on the streets after dark, after sundown.
It's crazy.
And so how could these students live in the dorms if they couldn't go out on the street after sundown?
Well, I guess on the other hand, if they were going to live off campus, how could they live off campus and not be out after dark, you know, coming home from class and activities?
Well, the answer to that is that they could live in Lafayette, which did not have sundowner laws. So that was a few miles away from the university. And the Black students at Purdue lived in boarding houses in Lafayette. But this meant that they had to get off the campus before sundown. It meant they could not go to football games or basketball games or participate in dances or any extracurricular activities. It meant that they had to depend on public transportation or walk a few miles to get to the campus. You know, they had trouble being late to classes. There were just a number of inconveniences.
And did that change at all while they were there in school for the 4 years?
There were still a number of Black students that continued to live in the boarding houses.
They had the sundowner laws and the...
I don't know when the sundowner laws actually stopped being in effect. I don't know the answer to that question. But at any rate, my grandfather said, this is unacceptable. And he did a bit of organizing, you know, with other educators. And they went to the president of Purdue and they, you know, said, this doesn't seem fair. And your handbook says this, and yet you're not letting kids live in the dorm. And the president said, there's nothing I can do about it. And so finally, this group led by my grandfather went to the governor, who I think his name was Ralph Gates at the time. And they said, they had two points to the argument. One was that the handbook said freshmen have to live in the dorms, and these were
right.
And the other one was that Purdue was a land grant university, and the land grant universities, there was something called the Morrill Act that came into effect sometime in the latter half of the 1800s, and the purpose of this act was to put federal money into universities, primarily to study agriculture and technology, which definitely fit Purdue. But it was also so that people who were not wealthy could go to college. Sort of the common working person could get an education. And it was supported by federal taxes. And my grandfather and this group made the case that we pay taxes, and therefore our children should have the same rights as everybody else. And Ralph Gates agreed with them and told Purdue that they had to let my mother and my aunt into the dorm.
It's interesting to me that even then, you know, in the late 1800s, that's a relatively advanced way of thinking. You know, let's make sure everybody has the access to education, which is not even necessarily the case these days.
Right.
The cost that it is.
Exactly. That act is still in existence and was updated, I think, in 1994. There was a clause that was called the Equity Act, which actually applied to Native Americans who, because they live on reservations, right, you know, have this whole other legal system. And it has been updated to make sure that Native Americans can't have equal access to public mm-hmm. universities. So anyway, so my mother and my aunt, 17 and 18 years old, they were just teenagers. You know, they were just fun-loving teenagers. They wanted to go to college. They had the unusual experience of growing up in the Black community and having two college-educated parents. So they always knew that they were headed in that direction. And they also knew, because of my grandfather's experience, that college was more than going to classes. The college was your social life and the football games and the clubs and the dances and, you know, all of that. And they wanted that.
And they would have gotten that if they had to worry about getting around.
And the first semester of college, they didn't live in the dorms, because that's when this whole fight was going on. This would have been the fall of 1946. So they entered the dorms in the spring of 1947.
How did they find that once they finally were allowed to live there? How did they interact? How did everyone accept them, etc.?
It was not quite as dramatic as people sometimes imagine. Even after Purdue was told they had to accept them, the head of that dorm, and you know, an older woman, invited them in for a meeting and told them they might not want to do this. They might not want to be where they're not wanted. And maybe they would be happier staying across town, you know, with the other Black students. And that is really, I think, where my mother and my aunt went, no, we're not doing that. We've done this whole semester.
And we waged the battle, right?
Yeah, it is not fun having to, you know, walk 2 or 3 miles and be late for class and all of that. So I think that was the moment where they really stood up and said, no, we're coming. And so the rule was that they had to be each other's roommate, which was fine with them because they were each other's best right. friends. My mother said that when they moved into the dorms, that at first, you know, some of the women were a little shy around them. And she said there were clearly some women that were uncomfortable, but they just left them alone. And little by little, other women, it was just a dorm. They all lived together and they got to know each other and it was fine. And by the junior year, my mother was elected secretary of the dorm. So they definitely integrated themselves into it. However, the thing that people don't usually ask about is, you know, they always ask, how did the white students react? They don't really think about the fact that my mother and my aunt had also grown up in a segregated community.
Right.
And had very limited access to other white people. It would have only been in the stores, you know, in businesses, even though my grandmother was a social worker and she worked in an integrated office. But my mother said it's not like she brought people home from work. It just wasn't that kind of mixing where they lived in Indiana. So consequently, one of my mother's regrets that I remember her expressing was that she thinks that there were students, men and women, who extended themselves and wanted to know my mother and my aunt better, but they didn't know how to react.
Nervous.
that, well, they just
uncomfortable.
They just didn't expect it. They didn't expect that these people wanted to socialize.
Okay.
And so they missed the signals. And so most of their social life was still with the Black students.
Were there any other limitations on them? Once they were there, everything was just normal. Or
they never talked about there being other limitations. You know, they talked about instances where somebody would say something rude to them. And my mother was a sort of the well-behaved one, and my aunt was the one who, you know, just mouth off if someone said something to her. But they got through okay. I mean, there were no really dramatic incidents that were reported to me. And what was interesting was that we grew up knowing the story, but they never made a big deal out of it. They just acted like it was a normal thing. And I think that's because they knew so many other people who had similar battles. It was just at that time, being the first to enter into a lot of places was, as you know, as a Black person, was fairly common. My mother died in 2003. And when my mother died, Milwaukee Journal, we lived in Milwaukee, wanted to do an obituary. And they talked to the kids. So my mother was, my mother had worked as a microbiologist when I was very little, but had then been a housewife since my brother was born. But she was a community leader. She was active in the NAACP. She was active with the school. She was something of a, you know, crusader and a...
Being a female microbiologist at that time is amazing in and of itself, but being, you know, having studied microbiology as a Black woman, you know, having a career as a microbiologist, and that's really impressive for the time. I mean, even for now.
Yeah, she loved it. From what I understood, as I said, she stopped working when I was fairly young, and then she went back to work when my youngest sibling, who's 6 years younger than I am. My sister was about to graduate from high school. But by that time, she went back to school. She got a degree in counseling, and she was working at the vocational school in Milwaukee. But when they wanted to do her obituary, they also talked to my aunt. And my aunt told the story of integrating the dorms. So that became what the journalists focused on in her obituary, even though, as I said, none of us had really... I mean, we knew it, but we just didn't think it, because they never made a big deal out of it. We never made a big deal on it. So right. We go, we have her funeral, and we get to the point in the funeral where we say, if anybody has something they want to say about my mother, now is the time. And this woman that none of us had ever seen walks up to the podium wearing a Purdue t-shirt.
Oh my gosh.
And she says, I was in the class of 1950 at Purdue.
Oh, that's amazing.
I didn't really know your mother very well, but I knew her. And I know that what she and Frieda did changed the culture of the colonies.
That's amazing.
She
showed up.
And she said, when I saw this obituary in the paper, I just knew I had to come.
That's fantastic. You know, one of the things that you and I talked about the other day that I thought was very interesting was you said they really didn't have much conflict after they arrived at the dorms, that, you know, some of the people were very friendly and the people who were not interested just stayed away. There was no conflict. There was, you know, no name calling or any kind of mistreatment. And I found that very interesting for the time. And I sort of look at what's happening in society these days, and, you know, people aren't so quiet anymore. They can't just live and let live, like obviously those girls did at the time.
I still think that there's something about just bringing people together, that when you're dealing with one-on-one, people are not so scary.
Yeah.
And today, for whatever reason, people sort of seek safety in their own community with like-minded people. And that's a real danger. You know, I think you have to be able to talk to somebody who doesn't think exactly the way you do, or whose experience may not be the same as yours. And then they, all of a sudden, they're not so scary anymore.
And accept those differences without
right.
having to make it confrontational.
Well, and one of the things that I see even in the choir that I, you know, that I lead is that there are people coming from all different parts of Los Angeles, from all different ethnicities, from different socioeconomic backgrounds. Some of these people would not speak to each other if they encountered each other on the street or in a public place. But when they come to the choir, they're coming to make music and they've found common ground. And yeah. So because they found that common ground, they end up talking and becoming friends with people who under other circumstances, they wouldn't want to be bothered with.
Because music is a universal language. Music it really is, does yeah. bring people together.
Yeah, it really is. And so, but I also think that, you know, with my mother and Frida, it's not like there were students protesting to say, don't let them in. Mm-hmm. That never happened. What happened, it was the older people who were running the university who had a mindset that said something terrible is going to happen mm-hmm. if we let these girls in. And nothing terrible did happen because the girls that were in the dorm, kind of like my mother and my sister, they just wanted to go to college.
Right. Was there a similar situation in the male dorms?
I don't know very much about the male dorms. You know, my parents met at Purdue, but my father was coming back from the war. And so he was 8 years older than my mother. And most of his friends from Purdue were also vets. And I think, at least from that vantage point, they just wanted to get in and get their degrees and get out. They felt like they had lost time because they had been fighting and they were ready to move on with their lives. I don't know. I just don't know anything about the young men who were the same age as my aunt and my mother.
So your parents were in the 1940s professionals, your father being a dentist, your mother being a microbiologist.
Yeah. And my father graduated in 1948. He and my mother eloped and then he went off to dental school at Howard in Washington. And then my mother joined him after she graduated in 1950.
And I liked the story about why they eloped.
Oh, yes, they eloped because they went to see my grandparents and they asked for permission to get married. And my grandfather said, absolutely not. Winifred is still in college and she has to finish college. And so come back, you know, when she graduates.
4 years.
And so they eloped, which made my grandfather furious. And he threatened to never speak to her again and told them that they would have to pay for college themselves because they were now married. And I don't know how they did it, but they did. And she graduated. And anyway, everything was fine. And, you know, everything calmed down. And my grandparents were always very close to us. Yes, everything worked. But it's, you know, it's a very personal story to those of us in the family. And that's why it was so shocking that woman showed up at the funeral and said, you know, they changed the culture of Purdue because we had never thought of it like that.
Right.
And then, you know, many years later, after my mother had died and my aunt too, both of them were dead by the time they had decided to name the dorms.
Yeah. So that's sort of the final chapter, other than your continuing trajectory of your very successful family. Yeah. The final part of that story is, when there was the dedication service and the whole family came back, and you had said you were surprised that they actually took two dorms and named one dorm after each sister, which was really impressive.
And the two dorms are right across a common. They're facing each other. And so one is Frieda Parker Hall and the other one is Winifred Parker Hall. My cousins, Frieda's two sons, both went to Purdue and loved it. And they stayed involved and they kept saying over the years, you know, they want to do something, recognize our mothers. And I was like, yeah, really? Okay. I'll believe it when I see it. And for years they were saying this and I just didn't take it seriously. I just thought, oh, that's very nice, but okay. And then about 3 or 4 years ago, my sister got a call from someone at Purdue who said, we're having a board meeting on such and such a date, and we are going to put forth this proposal to name these dorms after your mother and your aunt. And if you would like to join the Zoom and observe the board meeting, you are welcome. So all of us in our various cities, because we're all over. I have a brother in London, a brother in Milwaukee, and a sister in Chicago. I'm in Los Angeles. My cousins are in Chicago and Milwaukee, and we all tuned in and we couldn't believe it.
I wonder if, so it wasn't the family who actually pushed for this. I wonder if it was somebody, the woman who showed up at the funeral, or somebody that she was friendly with, or.
I don't really know who she was. So I doubt that it was her, but I think that there was, Purdue has a very active Black alumni group.
Okay.
And I also think that there was some concern. The president at the time of Purdue, and now I'm gonna not remember his name. He had been the governor of Indiana, Mitch. I can't think of his name. Was concerned about Purdue not attracting enough of the smart minority students that he thought they should be attracting. That they were getting stiff competitions from the MITs and some of the other schools, Carnegie Tech. And he wanted to help put Purdue in the map. And I think this was part of that effort, to sort of call out Purdue's history and say, this is who we are, along with some pressure from the Black alumni groups. And they chose this particular story, maybe because it's a very relatable story.
Yeah, it's a great story. Yeah. Thank you so much, Winifred, for sharing it with us.
Well, and thank you. I've enjoyed it. It's always nice to talk about it and always nice to see you.
Well, we'll be seeing a lot of each other soon. Well, thank you so much, and truly an inspiring story. And I just love that phrase that those women changed the trajectory of your family, and or your grandfather did as well.
Right.
A fantastic story. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
If you have any questions about the topics discussed in this podcast, you can sign up for free and message us, ficp.org. You can also find out more of what's to come on the FICP Focus 45 podcast series, either on the events page of our website, LinkedIn, or via our newsletter. See you next time.